Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Meet Sarah Klein. No relation, and too bad because I'd love to say we're related, even if it is by marriage. Sarah, who grew up in California and graduated from UC Berkeley in 1998, got into filmmaking after watching the documentary Hoop Dreams. We'll find out why it made such an impact on her in a few minutes. Sarah has spent the past 11 years living and working in New York City and the metro area. In 2006, she and Tom Mason founded Red Glass Pictures, a full-service creative production studio committed to great storytelling. Their body of work is extensive and eclectic. Some examples. In 2008, Sarah and Tom directed a series of short installations for the Beijing Olympics and a large-scale series for the National Museum of American Jewish History. Asked by the exhibition firm Think Design, Red Glass created a series of short films that helped tell the story of the innovators whose ideas form the heart and soul of the U.S. Pavilion at this year's Expo Milano. They also filmed President and Mrs. Obama for a large installation series shown at the months-long event. Sarah and Tom have worked extensively on a number of projects with collaborator, mentor, and friend Ken Burns. And recently, she co-directed 18 short films for his series on cancer for PBS. Red Glass's clients include the New York Times, The Atlantic, the National Museum of American Jewish History, the GE Foundation, Johnson & Johnson, and HBO. So let's meet the female part of this successful, creative, passionate team, whose body of work, in their words, is based on a simple idea, short-form cinematic storytelling that has the power to touch, teach, and change people. Sarah, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's work our way backwards. How and why did Hoop Dreams have such an impact on you?
I saw Hoop Dreams when I was, a freshman at Berkeley. It was the 90s. When it comes to actually the documentary world, it was just like an entire different age. There were no tools for making documentaries by yourself. Nothing.
And they weren't ubiquitous either.
Not at all. You know, in college, I mean, if you were lucky, you would rent sort of a giant, huge camera. You would be editing on a program that was very hard to access. There was no Final Cut Pro. So filmmaking still felt kind of like a tool of people in the know. You had to get older. You had to be, sort of let into this club. And then you could start, making films.
So you wanted to join this club before you saw Hoop Dreams.
You know, I didn't know. I was a writer. I was a creative writing major. I always loved films. But, again, I think a freshman in college in the 90s saw films and loved them. And some of them knew, yes, I want to direct them. But most of us felt like, well, that's something for another time in my life. That's not something I could do in here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do other things because the tools aren't really at our disposal. So when I saw Hoop Dreams for the first time, there was no reality television then. The idea that you could peer into someone's story on a, visually on that level.
Why don't you recap the movie for those who may not be familiar with
it? Hoop Dreams is a story about three kids in Chicago who are all part, all live in the inner city, various levels of poverty, and all wanting to make it as basketball players on the big stage. And so what Kartem Quinn and Steve James did is, they followed these boys for years. They got into their families. We met their parents. We met their relatives. We heard their stories. Again, today, we've seen that. We've done a lot of that. But then, we never had really a chance to actually spend years on that level with people going through things that were so different than what I was. And also with filmmakers who seemed to have the trust of this group of people that and these kids who were really trying to make it. So for me, I had read books. I mean, I liked Studs Terkel. I knew, Adrienne Lebrun. There was tons of authors who were doing these amazing
Alex
Kotlowitz, who did There Are No Children Here. There are people doing these amazing chronicles that were deep into people's lives. Mm-hmm. But seeing it on film really, really influenced
me. I'm older than you are, and I remember watching on PBS a series called The Louds. And talk about reality television. I mean, we followed this family. And no, they weren't impoverished and they didn't live in an inner city. But it was, oh my God. And that may have been, if I could put words in your mouth, the reaction that you had to hoop dreams. Like, no, holy cow.
Kind of mind-blowing. And, you know, and I think, yeah, you're right. There had been these moments of us as a culture being able, you know, Frederick Wiseman. There were people that were doing amazing films, the Maisels, that allowed us to kind of peer into these worlds that were so alien to us. I would say for me, at least, Hoop Dreams was in the theaters when I was in college. And it felt like... It was in color, which I know, but like that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And it felt like it was to me sort of that first real introduction to what documentary can do, how it can change.
So it spoke to you in the sense that I know what direction I'm going to point myself in. Mm-hmm. And so then take us on that trajectory. You see this movie. It's very impactful. Do you make any films while you're in school?
Didn't make a single film. I was, you know, still, again, writing fiction, nonfiction, still kind of following that. I do think that my writer voice is still always very present. And that's why I love podcasts and radio, too, because it's a lot of language. But after college, I went and I worked for a production company in Chicago that was doing then these sort of long format cable shows that, you know, now I think they're a dime a dozen. Then it was, you know, we were doing some shows that were, you know, sometimes crime, sometimes not, PBS, but they were long form narratives and it was kind of a new scene. You know, I was writing, I was getting out in the field a lot. I'd say one of five of them were actually pieces that I was like, oh, I'm telling a great story. But, you know, I was getting the chops. And in the meantime, I was
cutting
meeting
your teeth.
A lot of people. Cutting my teeth. I was meeting a lot of people who were also kind of creatively like-minded and wanting to tell stories. And it was into that process a few years when, you know, Final Cut Pro and the Canon XL1 came out. And all of a sudden, we were able to kind of start doing things ourselves.
You didn't only write, you could shoot it and you could edit it. So you were one-stop shopping.
Yeah, and I always preferred working with someone who could focus on the visuals while I was in the field doing, you know, producing and also directing. And but that being said, we could bring a laptop in the field and start editing. Mm-hmm. We could, you know, like everything, you know, everything just got so much looser once those tools came to us, all of us as filmmakers. I think now we all know the limits of those tools as well. It's nice to have very nice cameras. It's nice to have an editor who only edits because that gives a quality. But back then, being able to have access to everything was a really big deal.
And also to wear a lot of hats was probably an important thing, too. You know what it's like to walk a mile in an editor's shoes or a director's shoes.
That's right. And, you know, we used to have to hire these great cinematographers, but these were guys in their 50s and 40s, and yes, primarily men at that time. I think there's so many more women that have come into this field. And we hire them for these large day rates. And so we'd have to be very, you know, it all be kind of like these monumental tasks of trying to figure out what we were going to shoot. And when the materials came for us to kind of be a little more fast and loose, it was great. Now, again, I go back. Now I'm actually, you know, of course, I also like those expensive days when you get to really, really push the limits visually with great cameras now. But then who had the money to do that?
So back then, your focus, no pun intended, was basically documentary?
Documentary.
So nothing feature?
Nothing feature. I worked as an assistant on an Altman film as a producer's assistant. One of the coolest experiences of my life. I mean, I hung out with Robert Altman in hotel rooms. And, I can't even possibly say on a podcast the kind of hijinks that ensued with that. And I loved it. But I knew even then, I mean, I think Altman is kind of a documentary filmmaker's director. He was, you know, a lot of it was also kind of real ad lib. And I loved that. I mean, I loved that whole process. But I knew then that wasn't the path. I didn't want to go into features. It was too much like rigmarole.
But you know what's so interesting about documentaries, and I wonder if people think about that too, back then and now, how do you make your money from documentaries? I mean, yes, you can put them on television and PBS and whatever, and HBO now, but for the most part, people, even today, are not going to the movies and paying their $15 to see a documentary.
That is a big question. It can't be the only question, but I have always supported myself. I did not come, you know, unfortunately, I did not come from the kind of money that it takes sometimes to be able to do this independently. I was always thinking about that. I mean, I've been always very scrappy in this regard because I have to be. Because I just, again, I think as a woman and as a queer woman who always knew I'd kind of be in some way the one contributing to the paying of our, in my life. I never, you know, I always knew that this was an issue. So you just have to be smart. So I did some television, which these were things that were already funded that I would just direct or produce. I worked with David Holbrooke. He's the son of Richard Holbrooke.
Right. The late Richard
the
Holbrooke.
The late Richard Holbrooke. Yes. I worked with him, and we actually got a film that we were working on funded by HBO, a documentary. So that, all of a sudden, I started seeing a little, some lights coming through of ways to start making truly independent work and still surviving.
And capitalizing.
And still capitalizing.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Sarah Klein, a filmmaker who, along with her partner Tom Mason, founded Red Glass Pictures, a full-service creative production studio committed to great storytelling. We're going to jump around a little bit. The first documentary that you produced is called Hard as Nails. Talk to us about that.
So David had kind of...
This is David Holbrooke.
David Holbrooke had been very interested in sort of religious extremism. I mean, this is... at a time in 2003, 2004, right after, you know, not long after 9/11, when the evangelical movement was really kind of making its play. And so we started talking, and he brought me on to do some other projects. He had a little bit of funding. And oddly, we ended up kind of finding our way to some of these extreme environments, what we thought were extreme. These were sort of pretty intense religious camps. And not, I wouldn't call them cults. I think what we ended up finding was a kind of a thriving Christian world that we hadn't seen before. And we ended up at a Christian rock festival and met a young man who was this charismatic Catholic leading teenagers to, like, find Jesus and also to kind of defeat huge problems in their lives, suicidal problems, identity problems. So, you know, we thought he was really interesting. We thought he was compelling because he actually showed to us that there are two sides to this, to some of these movements. And this guy was both a fanatic and also giving a lot to these kids that he was working
with. So he just wasn't making money off of these.
No, and he had a really interesting kind of shade of gray quality in the middle of this black and white debate that we have been hearing. So we started following him, and we followed him for 2 years. And that is what became Hard as Nails, this HBO documentary premiered at Tribeca. You know, it was a really intense period of time for both of us.
I have to ask this question that I've always wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
You followed him for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's not all you were doing for 2 years. Or was it? It just seemed like, whoa.
For the first year, you know, before we really knew we had it funded in a big way, we were doing other things. We had some other projects. And maybe that was actually only about 8 months. But as soon as HBO came on board and gave us the funding, we kind of had the luxury, which is really rare, to be able to spend probably a true year of our lives just totally in that. It was a luxury. It, you know, that HBO ticket where they actually believe in really funding docs, long-form docs, is something that most people don't get. And we knew it even then, that we were being given kind of a golden ticket, and you don't...
Well, they don't suffer fools gladly. Clearly, you knew what you were doing,
we
and they
hoped.
Believed in you. Well,
right. Right,
it worked. You know, they were not proven wrong.
Yeah.
So you get your street cred, in a sense, from Hard as Nails. Now you start taking off. But this is still before Red Glass.
That's right. So Red Glass was sort of just a notion. I owned the domain. it was
why,
just like...
Why that name, by the way?
Well, so actually, that's an interesting question. My family, sort of the Kleins from way back when, possibly related to your Kleins.
Well, I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay. Do you know? is this the big reveal? we're sisters. We owned a bead store, beads and sequins and all sorts of crazy things in Chicago. My grandparents worked there. It was the only business that my grandfather could get a loan for as a Jew back in those days, 100 years ago, or, you know, 80 years ago. Red glass beads are the hardest to achieve. The color red is the hardest to achieve. So you can, it's, you know, and a lot of times my uncle and my grandfather would be doing some dyeing of beads. Like, that's kind of part of the deal. So you can get pink really easily. You just put a little of the dye, and you can get black really quickly. But getting the red, and that's always been known as stained glass windows, it's like, it's a very hard thing to achieve. So I like that idea. I also like the idea that it was nodding to sort of my roots in the bead store and where my father grew up working. And there it is. Yeah.
So you finish Hard as Nails. It's 2004. And Red Glass isn't born for another 2 years.
Hard as Nails came out in 2007. So Red Glass, I had started percolating the company. I knew as we were doing Hard as Nails that I was going to start kind of, you know, wanting to have some other projects. I wanted to start forming it. So it was really a loose forming in 2006. It was really 2007, 2008 that it started to kind of be created in the sense, because I got a couple projects that, you know, made Red Glass seem relevant. Which means I had projects where I needed to have a company for them to be able to go forward. One was a documentary I did with a producer, a French producer, called The Good Mother for Arte, France. I needed to have a production company to kind of be able to operate. I also got this project with a company called Local Projects, doing a bunch of films for the Olympics, installation films. All of those things said, you need to actually, like, this Red Glass idea that you've had as a domain name and, like, you've been thinking about, this
Act
needs to
it.
Actually be real. And David ended up doing some other projects. You know, we always knew that we were just making this film together.
So you were farming stuff out. And by forming a company, now you're one-stop shopping.
To me, this is, like, a really important thing for filmmakers, now radio podcasters, whomever, you know, creatives. I think really quickly establishing, you know, either a company or some set of tools that allow you to actually function separate than a line item or a work for hire is really important. So for me, I think the idea of establishing a company and being able to kind of function as a company allowed me to get projects and create projects that I never would have if I had stayed in the status of, you know, independent director or independent producer, which is weird because this is kind of language we're talking about. But being Red Glass and then eventually being partnering with Tom Mason, my current partner, has allowed us to kind of really be a full service production company where people come to us at the start of a project before they've even thought about the idea, and we take it through the end, or we create ideas and come to people and say, you know, look, we've got this whole thing established around us to do this. And I sort of knew that then, and I think a lot more people know that today. But, you know, again, this is like people were just starting to get domain names back then. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like a big deal to have a website back then. It was mm-hmm. like, whoa, you have a website? You know?
Yeah, isn't that funny? You have a website, which is more of a big deal than you having a company in a way.
Yeah, I mean, then now people kind of know, oh, yeah, you get Squarespace or whomever and you have a website. But then it was like you could kind of put these things together to make it seem like you had this sort of thriving company behind you. And
Fooled
really, it was
you.
Just
you.
It was total, you know, it was total bullshit.
How did you and Tom, not so much meet, but decide that yours could be a really good partnership?
He worked on Hard as Nails.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of showed slowly how extremely creative, talented, and, like, amazing he was on that film. So when I got this project for the Olympics, I immediately knew that he had sort of the skill set to really help it happen. I mean, he was going to be the one to figure out how we were going to film a lot of this in a way that was
This was the Beijing Olympics.
Yes.
But this is interesting because in my introduction, I called it a series of short installations. Is that a euphemism for something else? Installations are not films.
In this case, yes. So, the way that I define it, but I could be totally wrong and someone could correct me on this, but we call installations anything that lives in a space in sort of an unconventional format in the world outside of television, outside of the web. So for instance, like if you walk down the street and you see something projected against a building and it's a film and it has a beginning, middle, and end, or it's an interview or whatever it is, but the mere fact that it's sort of in a setting that is different than, you know, seeing
unorthodox.
On your phone. Yeah, an unorthodox setting that's supposed to be experiential, that considers space in its presentation. For me, that then kind of brings it over into the installation realm.
Gotcha.
Now, someone might be like, that's not an installation. This, I don't know. I mean, I didn't actually look it up in the dictionary, but that's the way I define it.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure precisely what that meant, because you also did that for the Expo Milano.
Yes, that's right. And both times we work with design firms, you know, for the Olympics, it was Local Projects, and for Expo Milano, it was Think Design. Both of those firms are, you know, they come at these projects with a real sense of the space, the way that the audience will flow through it, the way they'll experience the message. I mean, they're, you know, these are big design firms that are dealing with like huge public projects. they come to us to do a lot of the storytelling, to you know, to actually affect the people as they're stopping at the space and hearing the message. Oftentimes we do talk about, you know, how it's going to be presented, and you know, we talk about some of the design, but most of all, we are the people that come in to actually create the content in these spaces.
Once again, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Sarah Klein, who is the co-founder of Red Glass Pictures, a studio committed to great storytelling. Now, let's move over to Ken Burns. Oh, my God. Ken Burns. What an installation. He is. How did your paths cross? And I would have to assume, not that you didn't have street cred before you met him, but that really had to have really buoyed you and expanded your company.
Yeah. I mean, we've kind of been amazed at how that friendship has evolved and how sort of amazing he's been to us over the years. I first interviewed him and we first filmed him for the Jewish Museum that we talked about earlier. We did a project where we interviewed sort of current day icons talking about Jewish figures that have made a huge imprint in the past. So
on their lives or just in general?
In general. So, okay. But they had some connections. So, you know, we interviewed Ruth Bader Ginsburg about Brandeis. We interviewed Chabon about Isaac Bashevis Singer.
That's the author, Michael Chabon.
Michael Chabon. Mm-hmm. So Ken Burns had done a film on Ellis Island. So he talked to us about Emma Lazarus, who wrote the piece on the base of the Statue of Liberty. We met him, you know, interviewing him, kind of like what we're doing right now, except with cameras and lights.
And he's huge. And, I mean, it's not quite like what we're doing now.
Well, yeah, I mean, but at the same, you know, he's extremely easy to interview because he talks in amazingly brilliant sound bites. I mean, that's, you know. Mm-hmm. And we all, the three of us ended up talking before and after the interview, you know, and so I followed up and he said, hey, if you guys, you know, if you ever want to get coffee, if you guys want to get coffee, let's talk. He knew that our offices were close. And so we ended up having coffee with him maybe 6 months later. I mean, it wasn't immediate.
Kind of flowed though.
Yeah. And then it's funny, like since then.
Which was when? What year was that? Do you remember?
I think that was maybe 2010,
okay.
2009, around there. Since then, you know, we've done a Ken Burns on Story, which we did a film where we interviewed him about storytelling, and I can talk about that because we actually have another one coming out. But we did this great project with him, totally on us. It was just a passion project for us. We didn't ask him until about 2 years into the relationship to do anything for us except, you know, hang out and chat.
Have coffee.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with that interview. We all, you know, we all went out afterwards. We made the piece. He loved it. And from then, it just, you know, we went up and we've given, you know, we were consulting producers on one of his films. We've gone up and given notes on other projects. We did a film for his iPad app. We did the series on PBS. You know, it's kind of like whenever, it feels like when he needs some short pieces that kind of.
You're the go-to for him.
We seem to be the go-to. I mean, some stuff they can do in-house. He knows our style. He knows when it would make sense for us to do it. But it's been a great friendship. And you'll hear this from other people. I mean, we are not alone in the fact that, you know, there are some people who get to a certain spot in their careers and, you know, don't give back. And there are some that do. And, you know, he's just one of those people that he's excited by life. I mean, the curiosity that got him to make, you know, all of these films is the same curiosity that gets him to want to have coffee and dinner and meet up and explore with new people.
Because you can always learn. And you can always expand.
Yeah. So I feel like if anything, we try to keep that in our hearts as well, that, you know, that is where this all comes from. I mean, we do documentary not because we're trying to pat ourselves on the back or, you know, have people tell us about how great we are or anything. We ultimately, it came from this real desire, this real curiosity.
But it's also a passion. And that's the tie that binds among the women I interview. This is just not something to get you through the 9 to 5. It's stunning to me that what I have learned over the course of doing these interviews is the connection and the need to do this. It's bigger than you are, in a sense.
I guess it is. I mean, I think, you know, we all have our moments of, you know, you all have moments, but we all have moments of like, oh, what? Like, what am I doing?
Yeah,
but,
right.
But I would say that if, for me, I never have imagined being able to do anything else well, or I've never imagined wanting to do anything else. So it's sort of been something I've had to keep doing. I feel like I've been sort of a dog, like a dog with a bone on this, where...
Or on a pant leg, huh?
Yeah, maybe. I don't feel like I have another... I can't imagine anything else that would give me as much satisfaction. And I kind of also know that the thing you're doing, if you keep going after it, and if you love it, you're going to do it well, and you're going to be you're going to find happiness mm-hmm. in it. If you switch all the time, if you're always looking for that next thing, I think it all kind of keeps you on that surface level. You never really dig in, and mm-hmm. you never really get to that point where you can say, yeah, you know, I've done all this, and I've done this interesting
Yes, but
work.
Sometimes there's also, okay, this, you got to let it go.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
there's
of
that.
Of course.
I want to ask you, as we're starting to run out of time here, what's in the future for you? What projects, not tomorrow necessarily, but what do you have coming down the pipe?
We are really excited. So we interviewed George Saunders, the author, mm-hmm. An incredible author. If you don't know him, you know, New York Times basically just said his book this year was the book, the only book you have to read this year, the 10th of December, mm-hmm. which is also my daughter's birthday. So that's kind of fun. But we interviewed him. We're putting out another On Story. We did Ken Burns mm-hmm. On Story. We're doing George Saunders On Story. This is all part of a storytelling series we're building. We want to, I mean, interview, let's say, 10 kind of tentpole people and then a slew of people around that about sort of the importance of storytelling, about how story shapes our lives. This piece, we interview him, and we also use kind of some really, really interesting visuals to kind of plug the story. So we have puppets, we have shadow puppets. It's a really cool short, and we don't know yet. So we're releasing it sometime in the next couple months, but it's I can't quite say yet. I mean, I'm not allowed to say yet where we're releasing it.
And how long is a short?
For us, this is a 7-minute piece. Mm-hmm. We deal in pretty short films.
Which you preferred.
We prefer. Talking about this idea of a business, the way that we've built our business up to this point, the way we've been able to do this is we have a number of passion projects. We have another short that we're going after, but we have On Story. We've done, we did Miracle on 22nd Street for the New York Times. Those were all things that we did from our own pocketbooks mm-hmm. and our own, you know, excitement. We also have the section of our business, which is, you know, there we do some corporate projects, we do some client-based projects, and, you know, those sort of feed our passion projects. And that's sort of the dance we do. Mm-hmm. So this next George Saunders On Story will be sort of us putting out our hand as filmmakers rather than as, you know, a production studio making something great for a client. And that's the dance. That's what we're in.
You have to have diversity within your company. I mean, it's still telling stories and it's still getting out there, but you have to be able to do it on several different levels and in several different ways.
That's right.
So if you could change anything, would you?
If I could change anything. I think in terms of work, I feel like Tom, my partner, and I have this amazing creative relationship. You know, I would love sometimes to not have the mystery around, oh, a year from now, what's going to be paying our bills? You know, that kind
That's
of...
That's an interesting word to describe mystery as opposed to...
It's a mystery.
aggravation and
yeah,
fear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's... Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what we do, and that's... If we turned away from that, you know, that then we'd also be kind of dialing... You know, we wouldn't be happy.
Sure.
But we feel incredibly lucky every day to go to work.
Well, Sarah... Speaking of storytelling, mm-hmm. I want to thank you for telling your story. It was
a
pleasure to meet you, get to know you, and I just found everything that you had to say so fascinating.
Well, I really appreciate you asking such great questions.
Well, and my curiosity gets the best of me. Thanks for tolerating. Thanks again for joining me today.
Thanks so much.
If you have a guest idea for the show or a comment, visit us online at sandyklineshow.com. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.